Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome into the House of L podcast. I am your dutiful host, Lawrence Holmes. It's episode 70. I think I messed up on episode 69 and called it 70, but this is the actual episode 70. And I'm glad that you are here for the ride. Have a good guest in store for you on today's podcast. Now, I want to explain something about this week's guest. So, comedian Pat McGann, Chicago comedian legend, does a lot of cool stuff. He's a big White Sox fan, which you'll hear in the conversation that we have. We had a talk, and I had this conversation on LoHo Daily. This is where initially this was. I wanted to pull it and put it on House of L because it was so good, and I love talking to comedians about process. Not that I think that I'm a comedian. I'm not very funny at all. At least in my mind I am, but not publicly. But I do think that there is a connection between people who do radio, especially folks who have to speak extemporaneously, and some of the comedic process. So I love talking with comedians about how they do what they do. So Pat McGann came in here. This is what, maybe 2 months ago. And we talked, and it was an episode of LoHo Daily, and a lot of people listened to it, and it's fine. But I said to him that I felt like, at the time, LoHo Daily was still building up its subscriber base. And so, to me, the interview was now what I would consider too long for a LoHo Daily. I'm kind of tinkering with that, and I think I found a happy spot now between 15 and 30 minutes for LoHo Daily, and usually it leans more towards 15 minutes, although I did do a Cubs podcast that I uploaded today that was close to 30 minutes, and I wasn't expecting it to be that long. But I digress. I wanted to bring this interview to a bigger audience, and right now, House of L's audience is bigger than LoHo Daily's audience, and I thought that the conversation was really good. And I thought that Pat sounds like he actually just sounds great. Like sonically, he sounds really good. And we had a lot in common. So that's why I wanted to do the episode this way. I wanted to allow people who didn't hear it to be able to hear it. And I thought it living in a 24-hour cycle, not that you couldn't go back. You could go back right into LoHo Daily and hear the whole thing. But I didn't want it to just live there, and I felt like I did a disservice to Pat by having it just be there. So I wanted to put it on House of L, and I told him that. If you're not following Pat on Twitter, you should. McGann Pat is where you can find him on Twitter. He's a Southside dude. He does a lot of incredible stuff in the community. And I didn't know when he came in and sat down, I didn't know that he was a fan of mine, which is a weird thing where you see people on stage and on television. And this guy is opening up for Sebastian, for God's sakes. And him saying that he really likes my show. He loves the football show that I do. He had a lot of questions for me about that show. as some people do. I was really happy to like sit down with him, another Southside guy, and we found out that we have a lot of stuff in common. Like we're around the same age, and we didn't grow up too far away from each other. Where I was in the Roseland Morgan Park area, and he was just west of that. So I had an incredible time talking with him, and I wanted to share it, and I wanted more people to hear it. So this is my conversation. Keep in mind, at the time, he was doing a show, which is the whole reason why he did the interview in the first place. He was doing a show that weekend, so you'll hear me reference that. But Pat's doing comedy around the city all the time, and I'm glad that he made time for my podcast and that he's cool with this one being opening up on House of L. And there's some good stuff in here, like him talking about Seinfeld and what it was like to introduce Jerry Seinfeld one night. So sit back, relax, and strap it down. This is me and Chicago comedian Pat McGann. The morning show guy at Jams is Ed Lover.
So is he here in Chicago?
Yeah, he was right past him.
I knew he was here, but I thought that was like syndicated.
He's here like every day. Like he you'll probably see him in the hallway when you leave, but yeah, it's
Ed Lover. I saw him brick a shot in one of those Jock Jam games. What were those?
Rockin' Jocks?
Oh man.
With Dan Cortez.
I remember he had kind of an ugly J. And that's when we were playing, when I was playing a lot of hoops, and me and my buddies used to get on each other and call each other Ed Lover if you like brick some
shot.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I got to share that with him.
Yeah.
I'm going to have this played on Jams. Was it that bad? Do I need to YouTube it?
It was rough. He was like, I think it was wide open and like hit the opposite side of the backboard, like from the side, from the wing.
Oh,
the opposite side.
You're breaking my heart about my man Ed Lover, but hey.
Maybe he's worked on his jumper. This is like mid-90s.
I used to love those games. Like, I really did, like, because it would be a lot of fun, and they had, the 25-point shot that you could make and all that stuff.
It was not difficult to make it either.
No.
It was straight up.
It was like a Steph Curry 3.
Right.
Now.
This a raindrop or teardrop, what do they call them? Teardrop? Like the, when you put it up in the.
Floater.
Yeah.
So this is great. Since we're the same age, we can totally just do like the
remember when.
Yeah, we could do all of our cool stuff, like the moment when you realize that on G.I. Joe, no one ever died.
I didn't watch a ton of G.I. Joe, but I do get the reference for sure.
It'd be like plane gets hit, everyone parachutes out, no one ever dies. It's a really, really great thing.
That's why it's not violent.
You can
be as violent as you want if no one dies, right?
It was a Hasbro thing, so I don't think that they wanted that on TV, for sure.
I watch Tom and Jerry sometimes. I got kids, and I'll pull it up on YouTube and be like, this is what I used to watch, you know? And they're like, they're not talking. It's like, yeah, they're not talking. And then, like, they're still alive. Like, they never. To me, I'd love those cartoons growing up.
I did, too. But then when you get older, like, you see some of the stuff in it. Like some of the real stuff, like with Tom and Jerry in particular.
Oh, there's some.
The racism. And it's just dripping. But they changed it. So like if you see old Tom and Jerry cartoons that we remember, where they would have the, you know, stereotypical like mammy type character, she's now like got a British accent. Like it's
Mrs. Doubtfire.
It's like, so I saw it in the airport, and I said to my wife, I was like, they can't be showing this.
There's
here.
Some chauvinism too in it too.
Oh, it's
total.
It's
yeah,
out it is of not, pocket.
Some of it is not aged well, but the best episodes were when the humans weren't even in them.
I agree with you. I also did like the ones where occasionally Tom would talk.
Mm.
You know, when he was trying to pick up a lady.
Yeah.
You know, the is you is or is you ain't my baby like episode of that was dope. Like I love that. But I always found Jerry to be a hater. You know, like if you really think about it, like Jerry was a hater. Like he never wanted Tom to do anything but chase him.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. Man, you really analyzed it. I was just like
probably analyzed
watch it.
It
with a blank.
Probably analyzed.
Turn the brain
too
off.
Can I ask you some comedy questions?
Yeah, man, you can ask me anything.
Look, when I listen to comedians talk about stuff, I know that you get tired of like the rote stuff, but it is interesting to me. So I'm curious, what made you say I'm funny? I can be in front of a crowd on a stage.
You know, that was the hardest thing to actually. That probably held me back from starting when I was younger. Is I didn't have the confidence or like the. I guess confidence to say like, yeah, I could do this. Because I always felt like the reaction would be like, why do you think you can do that? Like, because my buddies were funnier than me, and I've been around funny people my whole life. So to then say, well, I'm gonna pursue this as a, you know, career, or even at the time I started as just as a hobby. But what made it like possible? I remember I met my now wife, and I was just telling her about it, and she was like, didn't understand at all the hesitation. She was like, do it. Why not? Like, all these people are from somewhere. They started somewhere. And we went to some open mics. I kind of, like, checked them out. And that gave me some confidence, too, because I was like, I could at least do that. You know, you go to open mic, there can be some rough sets. They're all over the city. Anyone can pop in any of those. And you see, like, okay, well, this is what I want to try. This is how you start. I could at least do that. And then you – because there are people that aren't even prepared. Like, I felt like I would at least be prepared, like, write something, memorize it, and have something to say. What I was not ready for was like the big lights in the eye. Cause I kind of scouted, like I said, a couple open mics, and I went to the one that most to me felt like a comedy club. Like I had been to Zany's before, and I thought that that was what you did. If you started stand up in Chicago, that you got to get to Zany's. Like, I didn't know that there was like this independent scene and like this whole alternative scene at the time, what they called it. I didn't know anything about that. So I was just like, I'm going to go to this place. This feels like a comedy club, and then I'll try and...
And someone will discover me, and I'll end up at Zany's.
Yeah, it took a while. I did get lucky. I had a nice first showcase at Zany's and got a booking. I remember I like did the open mic in September, and I got a booking like 2 weeks later for May. So I had like all this, and then like this May date was looming. And at that time, I was like going out to Walter Payton's Roundhouse in Aurora, and doing spots everywhere downtown. Like, I say downtown because I'm a Southsider, but on the north side, I would just be popping into bars wherever they had open mics and trying to get ready for that Zany's thing.
When did you know that it was a career, that it wasn't just, oh, you know, I like to do comedy, but I could actually make a living out of this. I can travel. I can see the world, and I'm good at what I do.
Yeah, when I was asked to be house MC at Zany's, I felt like this could potentially grow. You know, I didn't know what it was going to grow to, or, you know, I still don't know where it will all go, right? Everyone has this different path. But, like, when Zany's asked me to be house MC and they were paying me, like, a weekly rate that was decent, I mean, it was not, like, anything I could live off of. But it was, I kind of knew what other comics were making, and not that it was about making money, but you know,
you have to live.
You have to live. You have to be like, I get it. Like, oh, I'm the whole artist thing. I mean, I don't like to get into that. Like, oh, I'm an artist for my art. Like, I just like being a smartass, and if I can make money doing it and making people laugh, like, that's what I love. And but once you start making money, and if you are going to do it, you have to. You know, I got three kids. I got a mortgage. I got to make money, you know.
How hard is it to write from night to night? Like, if you're hosting and you've got a bunch of nights in a row, like,
yeah,
how do you go into your particular, is it, do you leave when it alone, or do you see what the room is, or do you already have always, stuff prepared?
So when I started, I was kind of like a prisoner of my material. I could only do like the stuff that I had memorized. And then Zany's, as a host, they were like, you got to talk to them. You got to ask them where they're from. You got to find out if anyone's celebrating anything. Like, those are the two things they really wanted you to ask. So I started with that. And then I started being able, I was comfortable enough where I had some answers I use all the time, like some stock stuff, but started to gain this comfort on stage to talk to people. And I did a ton of crowd work at that time, which I don't really do anymore. But at that time, I was doing a ton of the crowd work, so every set was different. And then I would might like sneak in some bits at the end to get them in the rhythm. Because as a host, you're supposed to warm them up and then get them in the rhythm of hearing comedy, and then hand it off to the next comic so that the crowd is like ready to consume comedy in like a rhythm form or whatever it is. You know, they're focused. So that was kind of how I grew in that phase. And getting comfortable on stage is the biggest thing. And then writing, you know, I don't write every single day. I should be more disciplined with it. But I'll wait till things start kind of, my mind starts turning. A lot of times I'll think of things when I'm driving and I'll jot something in my phone or voice record a note. And then sometimes I will just get a notebook out and just like kind of almost journal. Like, what have I been doing? Is there anything funny in there? You know, what's going on with the kids? What's going on with my wife? And then I'll kind of mine that material a little bit.
What's the job of an opener? Because I've always wondered, because you've opened for some pretty big names in the industry. Is it okay for you to kill as the opener?
Yes, I think so. I think that you should, if you're killing in a appropriate way, you should be up there doing, you know, depending on the venue, depending on the situation. I think that you should, you can sneak some new stuff in occasionally. But I think if, like, the shows that I'm doing with Sebastian, these people are spending a lot of money to go to a theater, to go to a show. Like, these people, they're going to be entertained. They're there to see their guy. They're there to see Sebastian. But, you know, they're also, like, he wants them to have a great experience the whole entire show. So he trusts me as his opener to go out there and break it open and, you know, get them going. And I don't think he wants me up there, like, trying new stuff or... But what I do not do as the opener is I do not do any crowd work. I do not do any local references really at all.
Why not?
Because I feel like that is his. And for me to take that away or to mention a premise before he has the opportunity to, I don't think that's cool. It's his show. I'm just there to – my job is to be good. Be professional, get him going. But, I don't think that people that are opening for comics, doing local stuff or doing a ton of crowd work, it's just a disservice to who's going to follow you.
When you're done with your set, how much will you watch of the other comics? Or are you in replay mode where you're figuring out, like, this worked for my set, this didn't work? How long do you give, I guess, the improper way to say it is, what's your refractory period after you go on?
When I do the Sebastian shows, if I am trying something new, I'll think about those new things. Or I'll just be – that's probably what I'll be thinking about. Or I'll think about, like, oh, I should have done this joke or switched the order. And then I'll watch him occasionally. You know, if I feel like if I watch him, if you watch one person all the time, they're going to, like, seep in your subconscious and you're going to be too influenced by them, I think. I enjoy watching his new stuff. I notice when he's doing new things. And that's how I kind of know all the stuff he's doing. But I don't know the order. I don't know the show from beginning to end. And then occasionally I'll just be in the mood and I'll be like, you know what? I'm just going to enjoy this. I'm going to go as a comedy fan and go watch him and be in the environment, which I love, being in an audience and feeling that energy and laughing. And I'm not a big laugher, but like being around their laughter, like I just love it.
What's the best crowd that you've been in front of? Like that you remember, like, yeah, this is...
We did a show in Pittsburgh this year at their Symphony Hall that was explosive. It was a beautiful theater right in downtown Pittsburgh.
Which is a great shows. City, by the way.
Yeah, and I don't know Pittsburgh that well. I've only been there like a couple times.
PNC Park?
I got a great PNC story.
Okay.
But that show was lights out. There was a show in Detroit that was phenomenal.
What makes for you a hot crowd? Like, what's the kind of criteria for what you want?
You know, it's incredible that I can, like, talk like this because these are all Sebastian's audiences that I'm getting to be in front of. I mean, I'm happy when I'm at a comedy club and it's a packed room on a Friday, Saturday, and it's just electric. But doing these theaters, and I've done so many now, I love, like, a Chicago theater-style size. Or even smaller, like the old vaudeville houses that are, like, 1,400 to 1,800 seats. They're, like, kind of... steep. They're straight up and down a balcony. Then you got the main floor, no center aisle. I don't like the center aisle. It kind of like splits the theater. Like I want seats were all right up in, oh man, those places like rock. Like there's one in Austin called the Paramount. Denver, I think, is also called the Paramount. Like now that I've been like so spoiled going to all these venues, man.
I went to a like, as I enjoy stand-up comedy, and I'm now, like, I have a couple of friends that do monthly shows. My buddy Dave Hellum does the show at North.
Yeah.
You know, he does that, comes back home once a month, and I really enjoy it. I saw a show Christmas Eve, God, maybe 5 years ago now, and it blew my mind. It was one of those pop-up shows where Hannibal was like, oh, yeah. Hey, I'm in town.
Man.
So it was Hannibal and Amy Schumer.
No okay? kidding.
So that was the to get you in
was
the
that
door.
Tonic Room?
Beat Kitchen.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's like a 300-person venue. And we were all standing for it. So you're going there. It's like, oh, it's Amy, it's Hannibal, it'll be great. Like every Chicagoan was bananas. Dion Cole popped in.
No kidding.
And did a set. I didn't realize this until it happened. I was standing next to John Mulaney.
Really?
Yeah. He was just he had come from Midnight Mass.
Wow.
Just was standing there in the parka. They call him up. He throws the parka to I think at the time his girlfriend, now his wife, goes up there. And just did 15 minutes and walked out. And it was incredible. Like, the whole experience was really incredible. And I know that stuff happens a lot in New York.
Mm-hmm.
To see it happen in Chicago
right.
was so
That's
dope.
A great point. That is a great point. Yeah, you don't see it as much in Chicago, names like that. And when those things happen, man, it is – and it's – to me – I always think about, like, yeah, it's so great for them. But to me, I always think about the comics. Like, what a great, like, we live for those moments. Like, these guys are going to be, like, Dion Cole's going to be up there. And Hannibal, Amy Schumer, Mulaney. Like, and if you were able to pop on that a show like that, like, so they are excited. They're, like, he's probably like, wow, there's a show down the street. Like, he couldn't stay away. He probably was, visiting his family down the street going to yeah. Midnight Mass. And, like, you can't stay away, man. That's these huge names. When you go, when you talk about New York, I was just doing a Gotham out there, and Seinfeld dropped in on my show.
What?
Can't stay away, man. You got to stay sharp. You got to try new stuff. You got to do it. Like, everyone has to go through that. You have to have those. So Seinfeld does that a lot in New York. But I got to introduce him. I got the call because I was headlining the show. And I got the call at like 4 p.m, hey, Seinfeld's coming into your first show tonight. And this is the first time I'm doing a New York club, like closing it out. Like, I was nervous. And now I got Seinfeld coming. And I'm just like, oh, man, I got to switch some of my good stuff to be. Because I figured he'd see like my last 10 minutes maybe. So I kind of like switched my order in my head. Like, I'm going to make sure my last 10 is really strong.
Did you feel like you nailed it?
I felt good. It was tough that it was the first night. I wish I had like been in the club, and like the first night at the club is always like you're kind of trying it on, you know? And a lot of the times that's a Wednesday or a Thursday. This one starts on a Friday. So you're thrown into the fire right away. Like, it's Friday night. You got to bring it. You got to start your first show. You don't get the BP of a Wednesday night. You know what I'm saying?
So the audience doesn't know.
No, the audience did not know.
So what's you introduced Seinfeld. What's the reaction?
So I like did my normal closing thing, and then I said, hey, I know it seems like the show is over, but it is not. When you come to Gotham Comedy Club, you never know who you're going to see. Ladies and gentlemen, Jerry Seinfeld. And the place was like, what? He's here? Like, and then just bananas. Standing up. They saw him, because at this point they see him walking through.
But they're thinking he's, you know, just there. And now it's like he's walking to the stage.
And now they're like, wow, our trip to New York City paid off. Like, Gotham gets a lot of locals, but they also get some tourists. And you just feel their energy of, like, can you believe this? Like, we came to New York City, and we're seeing Jerry Seinfeld pop into a comedy club. Like, it's awesome to see. I mean, it's really cool.
I'm so happy that we're having this conversation. I know you probably thought this was going to go a totally different way, too.
No, not at all, man. I just love talking, whatever.
That you were like, oh, he's going to totally ask me about the White Sox. And...
But I don't want to seem like I'm, like, dropping his name. I feel terrible that I didn't get a picture with him. But I didn't want to bother him. I didn't want to be like, because he's, you know, really tight with Sebastian. You know, they've had dinner together. Jerry kind of has said, like, that's the guy that I really love that's working right now. had him on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
I saw.
On. So I was trying to act like, hey, I'm...
No big deal.
No big deal. Like, you don't want to be that guy, like, up his ass, asking for a picture. And, like, so my wife was supposed... She did come that night from Chicago, but she was delayed, like, 4 hours. So she missed... And I called her right when I heard. I was like, you know, babe, this is going to be awesome tonight. Jerry Seinfeld's coming. And she was like, what? And
then, oh, man.
Delayed, missed it. She would have been like, can we get a picture? You know, she would have been.
It's a little, but that's an easier sell, though.
Right.
That's a much easier sell than if you ask for it. For sure. All right. Well, then let me ask you this. You do a ton of charity work. Like, you MC a lot of charity gigs. Why is that so important to you?
Well, when I started out, there's always these events, and the you know the South Side. I mean, we're from virtually the same neighborhood, and there's always charitable things going on out there. People are always looking to help each other. Our son had cancer. He was diagnosed when he was like a year and a half. Had leukemia, rough patch when he was first diagnosed. And then just a tough path because it's such a long path. And during that time, it was like, you know, maybe I could do some things to raise money to help people. You know, at first we were throwing it to research in pediatric cancer. And then we thought, you know what, maybe we could – it just felt like maybe we could see more of what we were doing if we gave it to families, because – then all of a sudden we were going through it, and we realized that families, you just need something, you know? It's like one less thing to worry about if you have this influx of cash that you can just kind of alleviate some burden. And, you know, I've reached out to the comedy community in Chicago, and they've been so great and donating their time and coming out and doing shows with me. And, I mean, it's important to me because it's it's just like who I think it's who I am, and I think that comedy is a great unifier. And I also been to a million different types of fundraisers, and sometimes they feel like a shakedown, and sometimes you feel like you're not getting anything out of it. I feel good about the fact that our fundraiser is just a fun night for everybody. Everyone walks out like, wow, that was just a shared experience, and it's a good time, and it's just good for the soul.
We're both White Sox fans.
Oh, yeah.
I want to throw something. What? Why are you pointing at me?
I was at the game when you threw out your first pitch, and dude, it was a great first pitch.
Thank you.
I was randomly at that game, and I was like, all right, let me see this. Because I'm not always there that early either, you know? And I was like, let me watch this. You had your glove, didn't you?
No, it wasn't mine. So here's the story behind that. They were doing a whole thing with media people throwing out the first pitch. It was a bracket.
Okay. Oh, yeah?
So it was me and Jen Latta. We had met up in the championship. So in the first two rounds, because I had done it twice before.
Oh, you had?
Yeah. So the first two rounds, I just lobbed it. Like, I was just like, okay, I'm just playing catch. This is easy. And then the last day, we were sitting there, and Jen was like, do we get to, like, warm up? And I said, yeah, we can throw the ball around. And there was this guy who was sitting. He had came in for autographs, and he had this glove from, like, the 30s. And I was like, that's really cool. Do you mind if I check it out? My grandfather played in the Negro League, so I have his gloves from the 30s. So I was like, oh, this is super cool to actually have one that you could touch, because I have his framed. Like, the original dirt, like all of it, like
that
it is
cool.
In there. And so this guy gave me his glove, and I was like, do you mind if I use this for the first pitch? And he's like, no, yeah, do it. Like, please go out there and do it. So I told the story this week on the station, but Sale was catching the first pitch. And I said to Sale before he went behind the plate, I said, can I let one go? And he's like, yes, but I'm not wearing a cup. So if you skip it, I'm going to mess you up.
Oh, yeah.
So just know
added
that.
Added pressure.
Yeah, the added pressure of this all-star, all-world pitcher telling you this. And I said, I'm not going to skip it. I promise you. And so I threw it, and he was, if you see the video of it, I'll send you the video of it. He's amazed by it. His face is like, what? And then he came back to me and he goes, did you throw me a cutter? And I said, yes, I threw you a cutter. So I played college
ball. Oh,
you
threw a breaking ball, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So
how hard did you throw that one?
About 70.
Man. Yeah, it was a rope.
So the only thing that week, Kevin Hart had thrown out the first pitch, and I think he had thrown it like 62. And I said, if nothing else.
In the zone?
Yeah, he got it there. I want to throw the ball harder than Kevin Hart did.
Yeah.
Like, that was the only thing that was on my mind. And I was like, the only athletic talent
I love that I had. That's what motivated you.
Hell yeah. Because, you know, I was like, not in my park. I can't have Kevin Hart have the record in my park. But it's the only athletic gift I have is my arm strength. Like, it's the only thing. I'm not fast. I'm not particularly strong. I couldn't hit. I had 2 home runs my entire baseball career. 2. And they came in the same game.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you had a day.
Had a great day. So that was the one time that I could actually, like, show out.
Hey, man, you play college baseball. You got to be athletic to do that.
I'm decent.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to DePaul. We had the club squad, and we played a bunch of NAIA teams and D1. We played Northwestern once and got just.
Oh, yeah.
I had to pitch in that game. I'm a catcher by trade, and I throw like a catcher. Like, it's right here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not. Nothing fluid about it, but I had to pitch because we got bombed so bad, and I actually did okay. And then my arm got tired, and I was throwing curveballs that were 12-6.
Wow.
It's a beautiful thing. Anyway.
No, that's great. I've really come back to baseball. I went into basketball deep during the Jordan years, and I grew up, like, that first part of my life, baseball, and then, like, I feel like I'm going back to baseball.
Well, I've been really trying so hard not to get too far out ahead of myself with this particular White Sox team. I really like them.
So
they're missing some stuff. They needed 1.5 more starters.
Right.
But Tim Anderson, I need more of it.
Love it.
I like there's something about him right now that I think is so Southside. Like, that's so, like, you know what? Yeah, we are gonna brag a little bit.
This is who we are.
And if you come at our guy, I think that what the Royals did back in April got White Sox fans' attention.
Yeah.
That's our guy. Like,
right.
Let's not mess around here. So I like it. And Giolito's been great. So
he's got swagger, and that you need that, especially when you're coming up. Like, they need leadership. They need swagger. They need confidence. They need all these things. And, I mean, I think that they're not healthy either right now. So their injuries are, I mean, that's a major factor. And they're still at basically 500. I think they're going to be right around there all. But they're a fun 500 to watch. I'm telling you, I like, there's games when it's not Giolito starting or Lopez. And the drop off there is tough.
It's steep.
It is really steep. And more so with Rodon going down. But they are still, like you said, I don't think they're that many pieces away. If they can be healthy, that's what you learn, though, too, or you're reminded of. You can have all the pieces, but if you're not healthy,
it doesn't matter. I was at the ballpark yesterday, and I'm not going to say who, but someone very well connected inside White Sox said, come here, looked at the schedule and said, we're going to be above 500 before the second week of June.
Yeah.
And then this person was like, don't look at the weeks after that, though.
Right.
And I was like, what? I was, because it's like Astros, Cubs, Red Sox.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
After that, he's like, but we're going to go over 500 before the second week. And I'm like, don't tell me that, man, because I'm getting so, like, excited about what the future may hold. It's pretty crazy.
I mean, they're doing things that they should do, right? I mean, they went on the road to Houston and they won 2 games. That was huge.
The Twins thing was a debacle, though.
That was terrible.
And when I saw Manny Banuelos was starting, I was like, oh, God, no.
But they had to get fat on the Royals, and they did. Like, you have to beat the bad teams. You have to.
And now you got Cleveland coming in.
Split series against good teams. And those will turn into wins in a couple years. I mean, even if they're a couple years away, where would they be if Rodon and Kopech were healthy? Like, those are pieces that they do have. They're on the,
yep.
They technically would be on the roster.
Yeah. Like, starting. That's, and that's that 1.5 starter, you
right.
know, that I'm talking about. It makes me crazy because I think about, like, maybe they should sign Dallas Keuchel. You know, that if we are talking about a team that's still hovering around 500 and still in contention for a wild card in the American League, which they are technically right now, would I want Rick Hahn to then spend some money on Dallas Keuchel? And I'm fighting myself on this.
Like, I'm totally fighting. Anything up. Just got to give up money.
That's all you got to give up.
Yeah.
And they got it because.
But to do it now, I don't know if that's the move because you don't have Kopech, you don't have Rodon, you don't have. Who else is missing? They got another pretty big name that's out, right? Who am I thinking of? Well, they don't have like a center fielder.
Yeah.
They don't have the
you're getting lucky with some of the stuff with James McCann. Like, he's been really good so far this year.
He's been great.
But
huh?
that's kind of the crazy thing too. Abreu like got hot and then got cold. And then yesterday he hit a homer. Moncada got hot, got really cold, and then he hits like there's a lot of good that, like, Aloy is exciting. Moncada is exciting.
Yeah.
Anderson's exciting. I'm trying so hard not to get excited about our boys.
I want to see Tim Anderson have a great season.
Me too.
I want to see him have another great season next year. And then you're really in position. I just think that then, where will Abreu be then? He's got another.
He'll be a free agent. But, I mean, I think that they want to bring him back.
Yeah.
I think, like, from everything that I've said or heard from them, they want him. They think that he's got value that goes beyond his value on the field, which is valuable.
Yeah.
You know, he is a 900 OPS type player, but they really think that his leadership is taking a step forward. And he used to be, well, this was a guy that people looked at as the leader of the Latino players, and now it's – he's their captain. Like, that's the guy. And you saw it with the Anderson thing in April. No one wanted that smoke with Jose Abreu. Jose walked out there, and I was like, that's the end of this.
Right.
And I like that. I like that about this team, man. I'm sorry I dragged you down that
rabbit
hole. Talking about the White Sox and me getting excited. If people, when they come see you this week, what are they going to see?
They're going to see, I have some new stuff. I mean, I talk a ton about being married, having kids. I do some local stuff when I'm home, which is always fun because I don't get to do it on the road. I think you'll see a fun show. It's going to be – we have the Saturday 9 o'clock show already sold out, and then the 8 o'clock show on Friday and the 7 o'clock show on Saturday are nearly sold out. So we're going to have some good crowds, and that place rocks. Like, Zany's in Old Town is a great club. It's trapped energy in there, and it's just a good environment. I'm really looking forward to being back there.
If people want to follow you on social media, how can they?
I'm at McGannPat on Twitter, at McGann_Pat on Instagram, and I got a Facebook page. I got a website, patmcganncomedy.com. That's where I'm at.
I appreciate you coming in here.
Oh, Lawrence, man. Thank you so much for having me, man.
This was awesome, and good luck with everything. And here's what I would like. I would like to bring you back in here at some point and do an even longer form interview with you.
I'm here, man.
If that's okay.
Of course. I'd love to come back.
All right. Cool, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed that conversation, and I do think that he will be on the list of people that gets an invite back to the podcast now that I have broken the seal on that. And I wanted to do kind of a round robin, but I don't know if that is going to happen. We'll just bring some of our favorite people back. And, I mean, things and careers change. I'm noticing that with some of the people that have already been on the podcast. And if you miss some of the great people that have already been on, you know, obviously Mark Grody, Jason Goff, the Kelly Kroll episode, Layla Rahimi, man, that episode was dope. Sierra Santos. I mean, you name it. For the most part, we've had really great people. Dan Rohn, I mean, oh, wait, that was Lojo Daily. Damn it. And the radio show. I'm doing so much content, I'm getting confused of where my content lives. Anyway, if you go back through the 70 episodes and discount the football episodes, you'll find some really talented and interesting people in the world of media. And I do like talking with comedians as well, like I did with Pat and my buddy Dave Hellum. Actually, that Dave Hellum episode, I don't think enough people listen to that. You should go back and listen to it because it's hilarious. And we came up with some ideas for some stuff. And I expect full credit when Dave makes millions of dollars off of it, or I'm going to sue him. Just so you know, and that he knows. All right, let me get to the emails. You can email, yes, you can still email the show. houseoflpodcast@gmail.com. In the second half of the podcast, I usually will take people's emails. And I know that there are some people who wanted to get in on the Black Like Me episode that I did for episode 69. And I wanted to I wanted to allow people to do that. And some people have, you know, guest ideas and whatnot. Like John. John says, I'm loving your House of L podcast due to the variety of guests that you have. I don't know if I have a true favorite since I found all of them entertaining and informative. Granted, I almost got into a car accident with the Mark Grody episode from laughing so hard. I know it's a long shot, but have you reached out to Paula Ferris? I know she is super busy, but it would be one of the greatest reunion shows. Also, ever thought about doing like a roundtable with the HF Mafia? That's from John. I haven't. Paula and I, we will communicate occasionally. I haven't reached out to ask her to be on my pod, but it's not a terrible idea. And she's got her new pod that she's doing all about religion, which is really dope, and you should check it out. But yeah, when I got to Channel 5 back in 2011, Peggy and Paula and Mike Adamley were so nice to me. And they didn't have to be, and they were. And Paula and I see eye to eye on a lot of issues. She's just, one of the things I've always liked about her is that she just has common sense. She's a genuinely nice person with pretty good morals and values and common sense. I'm extremely happy with her success. I will tell you, and maybe we'll get into it if I ever get her on, when I was debating, not this past contract, but when I was debating leaving sports altogether for an opportunity that was going to be a more newsy and current events, she was one of the people that I reached out to, her and Ryan Shiverini, because they're sports people who moved into that lane and have had incredible success. And Paula actually was like, do it. She's like, leave. She's like, you can always come back to sports. I ended up choosing sports, but her input on the subject was very important to me making some decisions. So, yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. I'll get right on that. This from Rapier Saunders. All right, that's a name. Hey, Lawrence, been a fan of your various shows for a while, and I ran into you at Beauty Bar. Oh, yeah, at Timbuk Tuesdays when my man DJ J Illa was DJing. Anyway, that made me think about the intersection of sports music in Chicago. I'm not sure if you're familiar with David Kelly, who is current legal counsel for the Golden State Warriors, but he used to be a prominent figure in Chicago's underground rap scene of the 90s. I dropped a couple links of his interviews. Keep up the great work. I'm always down for that. I should probably get J Illa on before bear season starts, too. J Illa is a friend. He DJed my wedding. I think he's the dopest DJ in the city. No disrespect. He's the Bears DJ. So on game day, you see J Illa on the field DJing. He's really phenomenal. I should probably talk with him. But thank you. I appreciate the running into you, number one, at Beauty Bar, and the suggestion of David Kelly. All right. Let's see. This guy's got a peeve against what we do over at Stadium. Ain't nobody got time for all that. This one is from Charles. Charles says, Lawrence, I'm Charles. You told my story. Oh, you're talking about the Black Like Me episode. Okay. I'm African-American, middle class, from 123rd and Morgan, went to Seven Holy Founders School, then Brother Rice, and then DePaul. He was at DePaul when I was at DePaul, a little younger than me. Yeah, I know my immediate family story going back 100 years to Southwest Louisiana, and then that, like you said, that story isn't pretty. Added to this, I have a young son. I'm also interracially married. Jesus, guy is like my mirror image. There's so much I want to teach him. My wife's family has a rich Irish history, and they've gone back to the old country and all that. I feel you, man. I think we need to make traditions, learn more about where we come from, but on the real, celebrate us, music, food, achievements, literatures. and give praise to those strong people that did what they did so guys like you and I could succeed. That's from Charles. Charles, I really do appreciate the feedback. It's interesting. That episode got a lot of feedback. And look, I enjoy interviewing. I think as a talk show host, it's probably what I do best. But occasionally there's stuff that hits my brain and I just need to talk about it. I don't even necessarily need feedback, but sometimes I just need to open up the Marantz or go into a studio and do all sorts of stuff. And I'm so grateful that my friend Afia, who is going to be on the podcast, and I think that she has staked her claim to episode 100. being able to celebrate with her family was a really eye-opening experience for me. And she went back and listened to the episode, and I was kind of like, man, I feel bad because now I feel like I'm trivializing what happened with her mom. But she enjoyed the episode. I did get a couple things wrong. The most important thing, Courtney Hall's family is from Senegal, not from the Sudan. So that's an important distinction to make. And I'll find a way to link that story that Courtney did because I thought it was so dope that she went back to Africa and kind of retraced her roots. But, and my brother was saying, he's like, we grew up in Princeton Park and not the Loden homes. And I'm like, But he would know because he lived there a lot longer than I did. But yes, we were in the Princeton Park homes, not the Loden homes. It's to me, it's six of one, half a dozen of another. To him, it was important that I clarify. But I'm glad that people enjoyed it. Maybe I'll tell at some point, I'll tell the story about me going to early involvement. I may have mentioned that when I was in grammar school, I used to, in seventh and eighth grade, I took classes at Harlan High School. So imagine walking from 95th and Harvard. Now it sounds so ridiculous. Like, it was not a problem at all, but it's amazing what you do, like your level of courage when you're a child that you lose as you get older and more experience. But basically, we walked straight down 95th Street every morning for 2 years, and I took classes at Harlan High School. It was quite the experience. In my Catholic school uniform, if you can imagine that. Hopefully my mother doesn't listen to this episode because that was where I had my first like major fight. I'll just keep sharing since I'm sharing. Walking down 95th Street, used to love Larry Bird. Had a Larry Bird basketball, had a Larry Bird cap. And this kid like ran up and took my cap and he ran. And so we ran. This is me and my boy Joey. We ran. And he was a Gillespie kid, the grammar school right by the CTA Red Stop. And we caught him, and there was an issue. And I got my hat back. That's all I'm going to say. All right, I'll move on to another email here. Let's see. Who else do we have in the emails today? Oh, Jeremiah wants to talk to me about racism. All right. Yeah, I don't. All right, I'll give you the first paragraph. It's not as simple as is black and white. It is more complex than psychosocial interrelationships. Nevertheless, if you notice that many, if not most, adult white people take issue with any white person being called racist. You know, It's almost become a dirty word, and I do feel like whenever that term is brought up, people shut off and then they don't listen. I will say that it's not always used correctly. When we mean to say that someone is bigoted or biased, we often will use racist as a catch-all for that, and I don't think that is fair, but I think that there are tons of people who are There are tons of people who need to be reminded of what type of power that they have. And like I said, we will eventually get into some broader topics. Like I will say this, that the feedback that I got from the Black Like Me episode, I think opens up the opportunity to have more conversations like that. And maybe even with when I was talking with Layla Rahimi, if you go back and listen to the episode of Layla Rahimi, I don't feel like I'm sharing too much, but Layla and I had a bunch of people over to the house for the title game. Championship Sunday is kind of traditionally the day when I invite people over to the house. We have a good time. We drink, we eat. Panther was a bartender, so she makes these incredible drinks that knock people on their ass. And Layla came over, and the majority of the house was Black. And we were talking about issues of race and culture. And it was interesting to get Layla's response to some of it because of where she is, where with identifying as Persian, what that, where does one fit in a racial conversation that is often simply Black or white, and without a healthy conversation of everything that is inside that spectrum. And I do think that we're learning to look inside that spectrum of, I'll just take my own experience. Like, what's it like to be a Black American versus being Afro-Latina? What's it like to be a Black American in baseball versus being Black and from the Dominican Republic? What's being Black like in the Dominican Republic? Not great. I can tell you that. When people were making fun of Sammy Sosa, they were making fun of him without understanding what's happening in the Dominican Republic. What's it like to have in the Dominican Republic in Haiti two people who are separated by language and hate each other, even though they come from the same place? Anyway, you understand what I mean. So it was great getting Layla's perspective on this and what it's like for her to navigate race, and how in many, there are some circles where she is not considered a person of color. There are other circles where she is considered a person of color. I was having a conversation with one of my students who identifies as a Syrian, and we were talking about how she has always looked at a Syrian as being white. And I said, that's interesting, because I feel like for the most part, everyone from the Middle East is a person of color, but it's not up to me. How do you identify? Anyway, I've probably gone on too long with that, but I just wanted to let you know that that's kind of how my mind thinks. And occasionally I love having conversations about this. And shout out to Shayna Goff, Jason's little sister, although I shouldn't refer, like, she's her own person. But just to give you a reference, like, I've known Shayna since she was young, and the conversations that she and I had back and forth after the episode, I thought was really dope. And I thought that she added some context with them being Afro-Caribbean. It was really interesting to hear their thoughts on then coming to America, not her and Jay, their parents, coming to America and what their experience was like. In America, being Black and then being in Evanston during the 80s? Interesting. So anyway, I appreciate you indulging me yet again for another episode. I just literally got a text back from Pat, who's really happy that I'm going to be able to do this. And I am looking forward to having him on again. So I big time thank him. And I thank you. I know that it's been a little helter-skelter with the pod, and because I'm doing so much, but I'm glad that you're still here. I'm glad that House of L is still a place where I can do whatever I want to do, and that for the most part, you respond to it. Now, go back and listen to older episodes. There's some straight-up jewels in there, man. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Peace.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.